Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, if you look out the window, you can almost see PAC.
Very nice. The Conservative Political Action Conference is having their annual meeting in Washington. And a year ago, last February, conservatives were not, shall we say, on the ascendancy. They were not very
glum.
They were very glum.
Down in the mouth.
President Obama was a one-month president, and the Democrats were about to pass everything they wanted.
The president was at 60-some percent in the polls.
And the Republicans were defined as Dick Cheney and Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh. So the Republicans were glum. Democrats were riding high. And a lot has changed in that year.
Yes, the people attending the CPAC conference have gone from down in the mouth to definitely on the march. Although, one interesting thing about this year's CPAC that strikes me is that this year they have a little bit of competition for the attention of the media and the attention of many people in the activist conservative movement, because since a year ago, we have all gotten a new sort of media darling, a fascination with the Tea Party.
But CPAC seems to unite all these disparate factions of conservative movement. They have even the John Birch Society is attending a CPAC.
The CPAC idea is that anyone who considers themselves a conservative should be able to come and vend and sell some of their literature and, you know, meet and exchange ideas. It really is a kind of supermarket of the right.
Yes, and I've been going to CPAC conferences since the 1980s. My first one was in, I think 1987. And they had a contest there, the most dangerous man in America, and the winner was Sam Donaldson. They may have become a little more sophisticated since 1987, but the attendance this time, I believe, is the greatest in CPAC's history. They really feel they're on the march, and they may very well be.
They moved into a bigger hotel.
And, the keynote Thursday morning was Marco Rubio, who gave a really exciting rock'em sock'em speech. And it seems like if there's any question of where conservatives stand between Marco Rubio and Charlie Crist, I think CPAC put that to rest.
Yeah, Charlie Crist, of course, being Rubio's rival for the Senate nomination in Florida. And just the fact that we would call them rivals gives you a measure of how far that race has moved. A year ago, we were all assuming that if Mel Martinez were, in fact, to retire, Charlie Crist would waltz into the Republican nomination and probably waltz right into the seat. So that's one measure of how much things have changed. Another one is that a year ago, some dirty names at the CPAC convention included Arlen Specter and Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins, who had just voted in favor of the president's economic stimulus package.
And I'd like to wish the president's stimulus package a happy one-year anniversary. Not everybody's convinced that it did what it was hoping to do. I mean, yes, I think the economy has gotten somewhat better. It shows signs of life, but the unemployment is still pretty intense.
Now, the president says that the country has gotten its money's worth, and the Congressional Budget Office, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, says that somewhere between 1.6 million and 2.4 million jobs have either been created or saved, and the White House says that the unemployment rate would be a point and a half higher if it had not been for the stimulus package.
It's hard to prove that kind of negative. It's hard to prove that things would have gotten worse had we not passed this. And so that's the kind of the problems that the Democrats do have. But the Republicans will point out that in the years since the stimulus package was passed, 3 million jobs have been lost, and that's indisputable, and that's part of the back and forth between the Republicans and Democrats on this.
One thing we know we have as a result of the economic stimulus package is another $700-800 billion on the national debt. And while some of that money may come back in revenues, most of that money has just gone out the door and contributed to record high annual deficits for the administration. So even as CPAC is coming to town, the president is appointing a Republican, former Republican Senator Alan Simpson, and a Democrat, former White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles, to run a new bipartisan commission on the federal debt and try to do, as the president says, the impossible task of getting everybody to sit down and get realistic about the nation's fiscal future.
And I agree with you. I think that what America really needs is another commission on the economy and the debt. And I think every time somebody sees something called the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility, they either shoot themselves or they realize we've heard this before. This is exactly the kind of thing that drives the CPAC people nuts, because we've had commission after commission to save Social Security, to save the economy, to pare down the deficit, and yet nothing changes and just gets worse. And so,
but let me just stop you right there, Ken, okay? Because that is a very popular view, which you just said. But in the early 1980s, we had a bipartisan blue ribbon commission led by Alan Greenspan. which did in fact save Social Security and put it on a firmer footing for the next several decades. And there have been tens of millions of Americans who have enjoyed the benefits of Social Security as a result, and the country lived with it pretty happily, and Ronald Reagan signed off on it pretty happily. So there have been commissions in the past, bipartisan commissions, that have done what they were supposed to do pretty successfully. The problem is that the dynamic for that seems to have broken down in our time.
See, I agree with you completely. With Ronald Reagan and a Democratic Congress, with Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress, things did get accomplished. There's something different about this era that, one, we have, you know, the fact that you have to have 60 votes in the Senate to pass anything. Two, you do have Democrats voting completely on one way and Republicans voting entirely on the opposite way. And three, whenever there's a hint of any kind of accommodation by, like, for example, a Republican, if Charlie Crist would, God forbid, hug President Obama when the president comes
out. Which he did a year ago.
Which he did a year ago. And that's one of the reasons.
Largely giving birth to Marco Rubio.
Rubio. And I think that's one of the big problems here is that even if you indicate some kind of interest in working with the other party, you'll get killed for it. You have the Charlie Crist example. You have Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. Every time he talks about some kind of a bipartisan effort, another county Republican Party censures him. So even if there were Republicans who would like to reach across party aisle, you have this tug from the right saying you do that at your own peril.
That's right. And one of the examples of that, of course, is John McCain, who, while he was the presidential standard bearer for the Republican Party in 2008, was frequently thought of as somebody who could cross the aisle on immigration, on opposition to earmarks, and particularly on campaign finance. But now, John McCain, having been unsuccessful in his pursuit of the presidency, finds himself in a remarkably tough reelection campaign, not from the Democratic side for 2010 in Arizona, but from his own Republican Party because of those instances of him crossing the aisle and doing business with Democrats.
We've seen so many incarnations of John McCain over the last couple of decades. Obviously, he was the media darling in 2000 when he ran against George W. Bush for the nomination. Then he became kind of the angry anti-Bush for the first Bush term. He dilly-dallied with possibly running with John Kerry for VP in 2004. And then after that, when he was clear that he was going to run for president again in 2008, he became a conservative, no longer the media darling, no longer the maverick that got him so much attention in the first place. But conservatives never trusted him. They never trusted his love for the media attention, the fact that he would love to take some contrary positions on immigration, on campaign finance, on things like that that the conservatives didn't like. And the fact that he has a serious challenge now, it's one, it's amazing it's taken this long. But two, in this new atmosphere where conservatives are on top, at least, you know, for now, he could be in serious trouble. The problem, of course, is J.D. Hayworth may not be the perfect messenger. He, for lack of a better word, is a blowhard. He was defeated badly for his reelection for Congress in 2006. He is a radio talk show host, and, you know, anybody on the radio doesn't know what the hell they're talking about anyway. And he also has a lot of baggage of his own. My point is that, yes, it's true that John McCain is vulnerable to a challenge from the right. I'm not sure if Hayworth is the right guy, but right now it seems like conservatives are rallying behind him.
And as we see these kinds of conservative internal dynamics playing out in Arizona, let's take a look at Texas. You know, we are within 2 weeks now of this gubernatorial primary, March 2nd gubernatorial primary in Texas, that has been getting a tremendous amount of attention down there. It was Rick Perry, the longtime incumbent, against Kay Bailey Hutchison, long the most popular Republican in Texas, even during the George W. Bush good years. And she was challenging him for the gubernatorial nomination, but now it's turned into a three-way race.
That's right. Somebody else who wants to be governor, and that's Deborah Medina, who's a conservative activist. She's backed by Tea Party folks. Now, she's done very well in the debates while Perry and Hutchison have been battling each other, and some of the rhetoric between the two of them is kind of childish and nasty. Medina is kind of a straightforward, anti-tax, pro-life candidate. First of all, on abortion, Kay Bailey Hutchison supports the Roe decision, although she's against partial birth abortion, and she supports parental choice. Rick Perry is anti-abortion, except in instances of rape or incest. Deborah Medina opposes abortion in all cases, no exceptions. She's, in many conservatives' view, the real deal, the real strong conservative candidate.
But supported by the Tea Party in Texas.
Supported by the Tea Party, and you know, she wants National Guard troops patrolling the border. She wants to end any kind of agreements with Mexico. show, but she did stumble in the interview last week with Glenn Beck.
Do you believe the government was any way involved with the bringing down of the World Trade Centers on 9/11?
I don't have all of the evidence there, Glenn, so I'm not in a place. I have not been out publicly questioning that. I think some very good questions have been raised in that regard. There's some very good arguments, and I think the American people have not seen all of the evidence there, so I've not taken a position on that.
I think the people in America might think that might be a yes.
Of course, this goes back to an earlier controversy that came from a three-way debate among these candidates, in which the issue of whether or not the 9/11 attacks were in some sense or another an inside job came up. This has been a, shall we say, exotic fringe theory that's been out there for most of the last decade. It's surprising to hear it at least even admitted as a possibility of a reasonable explanation for that tragedy by a serious candidate for governor in a state like Texas.
Well, Glenn Beck has a vested interest in this because it was Glenn Beck who outed Van Jones, President Obama's green job czar, when apparently Van Jones had signed a petition saying that the U.S. government was involved in the 9/11 attacks. Glenn Beck went after Van Jones constantly, day in and day out. Ultimately, the Obama administration backed off and Van Jones resigned. So Glenn Beck did have that little feather in his cap. And when he heard that Deborah Medina might have some questions about 9/11 itself, he asked the question thinking or expecting that she would say, no, this is nonsense. But the fact that she said something like, well, you know, we don't have all the evidence, or there are some very good questions here, it made a lot of people question whether Medina was ready for the big time or not. Now, a lot of Tea Party blogs in the aftermath of that interview have savaged Glenn Beck, saying he's a corporate shill, that he did it to destroy her, that he's really secretly working for Rick Perry. I mean, the whole bunch of things. So it'll be interesting to see if she can recover from this, because in recent polls, she was pretty close to Kay Bailey Hutchison.
This would give her the opportunity, if she were to finish ahead of Kay Bailey Hutchison, to get into a runoff with Rick Perry if he were denied 50% in the primary.
Right, and the runoff would be April 13th. Right now, the latest poll we saw that Rick Perry had about 45% of the vote, pretty close to the 50% he needs to avoid a runoff. But if Hutchison is failing, and I don't see any momentum on Kay Bailey Hutchison's part, even though everybody in the George Bush family seemingly has endorsed her, George H.W. Bush, Barbara Bush, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Karen Hughes, James Baker, that whole Bush organization is behind Kay Bailey Hutchison. But with such an anti-Washington mood now going on in Texas, I think she is fading. And the question is whether Medina still has the strength after the Beck interview to make it a competitive race.
A lot of anti-Washington feeling in Texas, which is probably not too unusual, and probably some Bush fatigue in that state, too. After all the years of the Bush family's domination down there, maybe they really can't deliver for a candidate the way they once could. Let's talk about other governors besides Rick Perry. This is the weekend, the exciting weekend. Ken, I know you are very energized about this. This is the weekend the National Governors Association comes here to Washington.
Thank God.
It is such an exciting and inspiring moment. And usually when they come and they have their luncheon at the White House or they have their dinner at the White House and a meeting, a couple, three of the governors can be seen sort of, you know, measuring the drapes a little bit and looking around and dreaming. And usually there are several governors, usually from the bigger states, but not necessarily, who are thought to be in the running, to be maybe major candidates or on the ticket in the next presidential cycle. But this time, uh-uh. I don't see one in the whole group of 50, with the possible exception of Haley Barbour from Mississippi, who is being talked about or seriously talking about running in 2012.
Of course, the exception is Tim Pawlenty, but of course, he's not running for re-election in 2010. He will be a former governor by the time 2012 comes up, and he does have a political action committee. There's also Mitch Daniels of Indiana, who's been thinking about it. I mean, you know, he says he won't run.
But let me just say, Tim Pawlenty is a legitimate exception to the rule.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about Mitch Daniels.
No,
I'm not so sure that he's going to be a real candidate or that he would be much of a threat. But what you usually see is you usually see several people from the 10 most populous states grooming themselves to run for president. If you look down the list of the top 10 most populous states, usually you're going to see somebody who's interested from California, somebody from Texas, somebody from New York, maybe Pennsylvania,
Ohio,
Illinois,
Michigan.
Right. Well, if you look down that list, you've got Schwarzenegger, who is, well, First of all, he can't run for president. Neither can Jennifer Granholm from Michigan. But both of them are in, you know, basically in the political intensive care unit anyway, right, and wouldn't be in any shape to run.
Both of them limited out for 2010, right?
That's right. And then, of course, you have David Paterson from New York, who this past week bizarrely survived a kind of non-story in the New York Times that everyone was expecting to be a career ender for him, and then turned out to be a bit of a nothing burger. We've talked about this before. It's just a case of somebody essentially being more in trouble from rumor than from actual stories. And then you've got Illinois where, well, you have the successor to Rod Blagojevich, who's still in the news, being reindicted and getting ready to go on trial. And his poor successor is now trying to sort of hold on to his office. He's no threat. In Ohio, Ted Strickland, he's no threat. He's trying to hold on to his job. You just go down the whole list and you don't get to anybody who's politically got a future, it looks like, at this point, until you get to Sonny Perdue in Georgia.
Who is also term limited.
And Bev Perdue in North Carolina, the recently elected Democratic governor there.
Yeah, I mean, I like the old days when the governors of the big states, like George Duke Majan, I mean, he was White House potential.
Actually, he could have been on the ticket.
No, yeah, yes, but
back
he could
in the glory days of the Republican Party in California, in the era after Ronald Reagan. Now, whether or not he would have ever been president is totally another question.
Plus,
but he didn't want to run outside the state.
Well, plus his name couldn't have fit on a bumper sticker, so I think that was part of the problem.
Well, he would have gone by Duke.
That's true.
Just you know, I mean, as we've long suggested, that you ought to just go by Rude.
Well, no, when Bob Lago Marcino ran for Congress in California,
he was Lago.
It was Bob. It was Bob. And when Nick Galifianakis ran for the Senate from North Carolina, they needed two campaign buttons. Seriously. And that's the real reason he lost.
Ken, do you have both buttons?
I do. And that's why he lost to Jesse Helms in 1972.
But anyway, Helms had the shorter name.
Which was what? but speaking of short names, somebody else is saying bye.
That's right. It turns out Evan can't wait. Evan wanted a bigger career for himself after he had been practically a boy governor of Indiana for two terms, and then he had two terms in the United States Senate, and at the age of 54, hey, Ken, you know what? He's had enough. No Strom Thurmond records for him. Some people, some cynical people in our business, have been suggesting that maybe Evan Bayh had higher office in mind, and that when he could not see himself getting on the national ticket in the foreseeable future or in any future, he just decided it wasn't worth it.
Clearly, from the beginning, Evan Bayh was ticket material. Al Gore considered him in 2000, John Kerry in 2004, and Obama in 2008. All thought of Evan Bayh on the shortlist for BP. Evan Bayh himself considered running for president in 2008. But as he has moved clearly to the right of the Democratic Party in Washington, or conversely, as the Democratic Party has moved to the left of Evan Bayh, I think he realized that his long-term dream of appearing on a national ticket was gone. Plus, I still will take him at his word that, look, he's not a partisan kind of guy. He didn't like the battles. He wasn't somebody who fought the fight in Washington. Look, he was very popular back home. He would win re-election overwhelmingly.
$13 million in the bank, 20 points ahead in the polls.
Over Dan Coats, right? That's true.
Former senator with great name recognition.
No, I think he would have won. I don't think it was a question of, like, perhaps Chris Dodd, who said, look, I'm politically dead and that's why I'm getting out of the race. I think he just felt that he had enough. First of all, and he also did not, a lot of progressive Democrats in Washington did not like him. They thought he was too much of the independent.
He was part of the Lieberman-Ben Nelson party.
Well, exactly it. I mean, the fact that he would blame the Republicans and the Democrats equally for the stalemate in Washington did not go well with many Democrats, who, of course, will obviously argue that it's just the Republicans' fault. But Bayh has never been that kind of finger-pointer. He's never been a partisan kind of guy, and which is so strange because his father, Birch Bayh, the three-term senator from Indiana who lost to Dan Quayle in 1980, was a liberal. I mean, he just didn't hide his liberal views at all, and one of the reasons he got defeated by Dan Quayle in 1980 was the fact that the liberals were getting destroyed in 1980.
They were being bulldozed aside by a moment in history. And I wonder, too, in all of this, if Evan Bayh doesn't feel a little bit of a 30-year washback from that 1980 election. And he just doesn't want to be part of it. He does not want to be part of the carnage if the Democrats are going to get slaughtered this coming November.
Yeah, I don't think that's it, though, because I don't think he was going to lose. Look, we have no idea how big this Republican revival will be in November, and it's very possible that Bayh could have fallen like other Democrats will eventually fall. But I still think he would have won. I just don't think he just wanted to go through it again. The Democrats in Washington are not crazy about him. He doesn't didn't like the yelling back and forth, nothing gets done, and I think he just had enough.
So Bai is out. We know that Dan Coats was interested in getting back at his old seat, a seat that he refused to defend when Evan Bai first showed interest in it 12 years ago. And he's interested now again at this stage of his career, despite the fact that he seems to have kind of become an East Coaster and has homes in Virginia and North Carolina and seems to be representing a lot of clients as a Washington lobbyist. Is he automatic just because of his name recognition, or can the Tea Party of Indiana and the more conservative forces or more populist forces within the Indiana Republican Party grab this one?
Well, there are other Republicans running, including John Hostetler, the former congressman who lost his own seat in 2006 by 22 points, so I'm not sure if he's the strongest opposition. I've seen some resistance from Tea Party folks in Indiana saying they don't like the fact that Dan Coats became the anointed Republican challenger, anointed by Washington. They don't like that. But if Mitch Daniels and maybe Dick Lugar and others rally behind Coats, Coats will be the clear nominee. A lot of people were criticizing Evan Bai for dropping out right before the filing deadline, and they say, well, they're leaving us in the lurch. But what it looks like is that the Democratic State Central Committee can name a nominee by June 30th. And if they can, and it looks like it's going to be Brad Ellsworth, the congressman from the 8th Congressional District in Indiana, if they can, they will save a divisive primary, an expensive primary, while the Republicans do have to go through the primary on May 4th. However, if the progressive wing of the Democratic Party didn't like or was not fond of Evan Bai, they're going to really not like Brad Ellsworth, who is pro-gun, pro-life, a very conservative blue dog. But maybe that's the kind of Democrat who can win in Indiana.
They would probably prefer him to Dan Coats or John Hostetler or anyone that the Tea Party movement would be likely to support in Indiana.
Yeah, I still think this is a Republican pickup, as is North Dakota, Illinois, and Delaware.
At one time, the Democrats thought they might be getting some back from the Republican side in 2010. They had their eye on six Republican retirements. Several of those, at least, looked like good prospects for pickups. And they also were hoping for Louisiana and North Carolina incumbents they thought they could get. At this point, Ken, do you see the Democrats picking up any of those eight?
I don't, but I still think you have to watch Kentucky. If Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, is the Republican nominee, Democrats are more confident of their chances against Rand Paul in November. But, of course, the Democrats have their own battle for the nomination. And you should look at Missouri, too. Rory Blunt, the former House Majority Whip, who's coming back to run for the Senate for Kit Bond's seat. Not every Republican is crazy about him. The polls show him with a slight lead right now over Robin Carnahan, she, the daughter of Gene Carnahan and the late Governor Mel Carnahan. That's going to be a very close race, too. Those are two seats the Republicans should watch.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Bye-bye, baby. Remember, you're my baby when they give you the eye. Although I know that you care, won't you write and declare that though on the loose, you are still on the square. I'll be gloomy, but send that rainbow to me then. My shadows will fly, though you'll be gone for a while. I know that I'll be smiling with my baby by and by and by, with my baby by
and
by.
In the sweet